Hi, I'm Moji Alawodeyau from the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod, the only podcast that helps you navigate the news in this post-pro anti-abortion hellscape. Each week, with co-host Liz Winstead, we dissect all the news from that sketchy intersection of abortion and misogyny with providers and activists working on the ground. The cherry on top is we have amazing comedy guests who help us laugh through the rage. Feminist Buzzkills Live drops Fridays wherever you pod. Listen and subscribe, because when BS is popping, we pop off.
Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance or don't understand the differences between insurance plans or have surprise medical bills, out-of-control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isgoff.
And this is another edition of the Spy Talk podcast. This week, like everybody else, we're talking about special operations in Venezuela and their ramifications beyond the region. And we are bringing in some special expertise to the discussion, of course, first with Luis Rueda, a former senior CIA intelligence officer who spent 28 years in the agency's clandestine service, which included three important assignments in Latin America. He's also an expert in counterterrorism and counter-narcotics. We're also pleased to have with us Spy Talk contributing editor Peter Eisner, who over his long and distinguished journalism career reported from Venezuela, Panama, Mexico, and throughout Latin America for the Associated Press and Newsday. In the 1980s, he was also the AP's bureau chief in Caracas. So, welcome, gentlemen. Luis, let me start with you first. Trump told the New York Times that the U.S. is going to run Venezuela for maybe years. How do you think that's going to go down with Venezuela and its neighbors?
I don't think it's going to go down well. You have to remember that Latin America, Venezuela, Colombia, all the countries in the region have had a checkered history with the United States. There is a view that the U.S. has always been mucking around in internal affairs, overthrowing governments, rigging elections, and nothing is going to go, is going to be looked at well by the Latin American audience.
So do you think that that outweighs Venezuelan relief at getting rid of at least the top of the Venezuelan government? I mean, the regime is still in place. It's a mixed situation. Do you have any predictions on where this is going to go? There are many power centers in Venezuela.
Yeah, prediction is very hard. Your point is well taken. This is not regime change. This is a palace coup. It looks like from the outside, and I have no special insight into what happened, but it looks like Maduro was removed with the connivance of at least some elements of the Venezuelan government. The regime is still in place. One player and his wife are out, but virtually everybody's in place. There has been no effort to change the government. There is no effort to restore democracy. So the first thing I would say is we have not engaged in regime change. It is probably an internal coup egged on by the U.S., and the U.S. provided the muscle. You know, the U.S. history of regime change and the results thereof have not been pretty. In general, all our efforts to change governments and regimes have been successful in the changing, and the aftermath has been a disaster that's led to insurgencies, revolutions, dictatorships, bloodbaths. I think you're going to have an initial joy on the part of the Venezuelans that he's gone, but they're expecting changes. And if you're leaving the regime in place that has led to the mess they're in, they're not going to see much change. And then there's, you know, this is sort of like Iraq. We got rid of Saddam, and then everybody expected, okay, let the good times roll, and they did not. And I don't know if the good times are going to go roll in Venezuela.
You know, along those lines, Luis, when I was watching Trump's press conference on Saturday, and he said, we're going to run Venezuela, and all I could think of is when he said that was Iraq, you know, a experience which you are well familiar with, having, in addition to your counter-narcotics expertise in Latin America, you were the head of the Iraq Operations Group for the CIA on the in the run-up to the 2003 invasion. And of course, you know, as you point out, the big question there was, what happens the day after? What are the plans for running the country whose leader we've just deposed after we get rid of him? And of course, in Iraq, it was a disaster. I mean, did that parallel strike you as much as it did me when watching Trump's comments the other day?
It struck me from the beginning when I found out that the U.S. has removed Maduro. We're never really good at either running the country or not running the country. I don't get a sense that we are running the country. I get a sense that what we're doing is strong-arming the country, blackmailing the country, threatening the country to give us what we want without real concern as to what takes the place of what exists now.
But the big difference between Baghdad and Caracas, it seems to me, is that we wiped out the Iraqi government, essentially. Anyone who had been a member of the Ba'ath Party, we dismissed, mm-hmm. we disbanded the army. And I think the takeaway from that with the Trump people, I don't know how deeply they think about anything, frankly. The difference is they've left the regime in place. Figure, these people can make the trains run on time, so to speak. And we will just bend them to our will.
Yeah, they can't. See, the difference in Iraq, yes, we eliminated the regime. We outlawed the Ba'ath Party. We got rid of all the structures of power. And there was nothing really to replace it. In Venezuela, you do have something to replace it. You have what we and the rest of the world consider a legitimately elected government, the Corina Machado people. And you have an opportunity to say, okay, the illegitimate government is gone. Let's install a legitimate government that we can work through or with. We haven't done that. We seem to always choose the worst path possible. Get rid of the guy, leave the dictatorship in power, and forget about anybody else.
Let's bring Peter Eisner into the discussion, the former Caracas bureau chief for the AP, for the Associated Press. Peter, what is your sense of how the Venezuelan public is reacting to this, and you know what happens next?
Okay, well, it obviously we're all in guessing mode here. I can say a couple of things. A couple of times have tuned in via this wonderful app I have to radio stations in Venezuela, just like flipping through 30, 40, 50 radio stations. Hmm. The majority of them are playing music, as always. Some of the conversation that I've listened to has been obviously about the news. It's been uniformly people talking about speaking in favor of the inheritors of the Chavez revolution, saying that the seizure was illegal and such. haven't heard anything talking about democracy, talking in favor of Machado or anything like that. I remember one day, some years back, while Chavez was in power, happened to be sitting in Havana watching a TV program coming from Caracas, where people were marching in tearful adoration of Chavez, and you know, demonstration that looked beyond just something that was paid for. I think that the United States faces a bunch of problems. One is there's lots of support for the Chavistas, despite the failures that they've experienced under Maduro for the last 13 years. And I think if I had to guess, I would agree with Luis that it's certainly a palace coup, strong-armed. And I think that there were people on the U.S. side, probably the agency and probably the military, saying that if we go too far here, we're going to have chaos, as we had in Iraq. We'll do what the president wants, but we're not going to decapitate this regime. And I'm not sure at all it's going to work.
Do what the president wants, other than getting access to Venezuelan oil. What is it the president wants?
I don't even think they're getting access to Venezuelan oil per se. I think they can get access to the oil that's being produced, which isn't very much, and stop it from going places they don't want it to go, like Cuba especially. But the whole idea of putting together a system where the United States is going to just move in and start pumping oil and shipping it wherever they want, it's a fantasy. It's as much of a fantasy as building battleships. Ain't going to happen.
It's a fantasy. Why is it a fantasy, Peter?
Well, number one, they're probably producing around 900,000 barrels a day, of which 800,000 are available for shipment. I've been doing some research. Maybe 50 to 100,000 of that goes to Cuba, but the vast majority of this oil is so-called, and you know, let's not go too far into the weeds here, but it's important. So-called sour heavy oil. It's not easily usable, and it sells at deep discount for the international market. It's not valuable oil until it gets refined by specialized refineries. The United States could pay Exxon and Conoco, and Chevron is already in Cuba, to do something with the existing oil, but it's a loser for U.S. oil companies. There's a glut on oil, and the oil companies don't want to produce more oil to drop the price of oil more.
Not only that, how do you protect them? I mean, you put American oil workers into Venezuela. There's got to be security.
Absolutely.
There are threats. There are guerrilla groups in the, you know, on the Colombian border.
As I understand it, the only interest short term that the oil companies would get into, and also supported by U.S. taxpayer financing, would be to go to the only place where they have a quicker ability to haul in some oil, which is Lake Maracaibo, which is obviously drilling in the lake. The system is broken down. They would have to retool it. They probably haven't even looked at it. 2 or 3 years from now, they might be able to haul 50,000 to 100,000 barrels of oil a day out of there, which is lighter oil, easy to sell on the market. But again, there again, it's away from Caracas, maybe easier to defend, but it would involve U.S. defense. How's that going to work? There's no U.S. military presence in Venezuela right now. And how's that going to go over if the United States starts sending in tens of thousands of troops only to protect the oil, much less doing anything to protect the idea of democracy or democracy building.
I can't see Trump sending in tens of thousands of troops. Absolutely not. Let's go back to this. You raise some interesting security questions, however. And Luis, I want to ask you, if you were in charge of Venezuelan operations now, given the current situation, the way you see it, like any other news consumer, you're not inside the agency anymore. But from what you see, what would be your mission right now, your priorities in Caracas? I mean, can we assume that you would be making overtures to Venezuelan intelligence and security organs to try to suborn them in some way? What's your priority?
I wouldn't say suborn. At this stage, given that the U.S. government is supporting the existing regime, the priority would be to making overtures to intelligence, to security, to the military, to bring them into the U.S. sphere. We want to use them as force multipliers, as you mentioned, providing security to oil workers and that sort of thing. You want them to come in and say, look, we'll do that for you. You don't need to put boots on the ground. We'll take care of it. So you're trying to make the contacts. You're providing them training. You're weaning them away from the Cubans and bringing them into the U.S. sphere, because that's what you need to prop up the government initially.
And do you say to them, if you're a CIA case officer sent to Caracas today and he goes to officials in the Interior Ministry or Venezuelan intelligence directly and says, look, we can do this the easy way or the hard way? Is there a lot of money changing hands?
Yeah, you don't want to do the hard way right away. You don't want to go in with threats. You want to win them over. They understand what the hard way is. You want to go in and say, here's what's the benefits for you. Here's what you're going to get out of it. Yes, money's going to change hands. We're going to want to win people over. Sometimes that takes money. That takes acknowledging what their personal interests are, what their benefits are. The threat's going to be overhanging, and frankly, Trump is going to make plenty of threats to them. Then they'll see that. You don't have to go. You want to go in as the good guy. So yeah, there'll be offers of training. There'll be offers of financial support.
Luis, let me ask you about Cuba, because we've made multiple references now to the administration's goal of squeezing Cuba further, keeping Venezuelan oil out of Cuban hands. Rubio, who's long dreamed of getting rid of the communist regime in Cuba, said if he was in Havana, they should be a little bit worried now. Now, you are a Cuban American. Your father fought in the Bay of Pigs. You joined the CIA in part because you shared the anti-communist views of many Cuban Americans. As you look at what we are doing in Venezuela and the potential implications for Cuba, I'd be really fascinated to hear your thoughts and whether you think this can be the start of an effort to get rid of the communist regime in Havana.
Good question. And I'll preface it by saying that one of the issues with successful covert action or regime change is that it gives a U.S. administration a sense of, well, we can do this everywhere and we'll succeed. And you saw that after the CIA coup in Iran in the 50s, and we went on to Guatemala, we went on to Cuba, we went on to Chile. And one of the things that people have to understand is Cuba is not Venezuela. That is not going to be a drop Delta Force in, remove somebody, and off we go. The other side is that this administration is lucky in that Cuba, I say this for the administration, not for the Cuban people, is on the verge of collapse. It is the worst it has been in a very long time, and it won't take much to push. Cutting off Venezuelan oil leaves it pretty much with some Russian and Mexican petroleum. The situation's going to get bad. I think the U.S. has a better than even chance of toppling the Cuban government. The problem is what comes afterwards. And this is where we constantly fail. We fall down. You can't go in and poke it, drop something, and then walk away, because then you're left with chaos, something worse. You're going to get a bunch of people washing up on our shores. You got to go in and control what comes after. You got to ride the horse all the way through the situation.
Luis, I think we've got the same issue in Venezuela. It kind of reminds me crazily of, I keep on thinking of this moment in National Lampoon's Vacation when Chevy Chase is walking along at the Hoover Dam and he says, oh, look, there's something leaking. And he just pulls out a little plug and he goes walking along. And a couple hours later, the whole dam collapses. And look, Venezuela is practically failing. It's a failed, 25% of the country has left. The concept of providing minimum amounts of food to the country, and you know, these little packages of care packages is collapsing.
MREs.
The World Food Program is providing, you know, a couple of million meals equivalent, maybe 5-6 million meals equivalent a day. But of the 30 million or people in the country, 80% are listed as being impoverished, and maybe half of them are food challenged and going toward starvation.
And it's been reported today that the Venezuelan government is paying people out of its reserves. This is going to run out of cash sometime soon. So all those government workers, et cetera, from bus drivers to security agents, aren't going to be paid.
Luis, let me take you back to your comment a couple minutes ago that the U.S. has a better than even chance of toppling the Cuban government. How do you imagine that would happen? Given your questions about the day after, and at the same time, all the problems with the Cuban government itself and its management of the Cuban economy. I mean, would that be a good thing or a bad thing at this point, in your view?
That's a good question. I honestly don't know. I mean, the Cuban people are getting close to seeing Cubans starve to death. I mean, it's bad. It's significantly bad. So any positive change, any change in the government is going to be a positive thing. The problem is we can't guarantee that it's not going to get worse. I don't see the Cuban security apparatus collapsing as quickly as the Venezuelan did, or if they just might have not done anything. There are too many people in the regime making money and having power to just give it up. So it would be a fight.
How do you see that unfolding? Do you see popular uprisings in the streets? It seems like the regime can handle that pretty easily. Do you see, especially considering Marco Rubio's obsession with Cuba, can you see CIA directing programs to reach out to Cuban officials who might be malleable? What's the thinking? And I mean, we've got a totally different kind of regime running things now.
But yeah.
Can you imagine what career CIA people are thinking about Cuba and what to do?
Well, they're thinking everything. I mean, you know, it's one of the things when you work at the agency, you look at every possibility. I think realistically, our best expectation would be one, to build a coalition in Latin America, which is not going to be extremely hard after Venezuela, but to build a coalition where there is pressure. For example, Mexico either ceasing oil shipments to Cuba or putting significant conditions, at the same time reaching out to the security elements in Cuba sort of like I think the U.S. did in Venezuela, and said, look, it's in your interest to get rid of this. We'll take care of you. You're not going to lose benefits, but you need to get the upper structure out of there. And we'll go in and we'll help you. But you need to open up your economy. You need to do a certain a bunch of things. And I think that's probably the best way in trying to force the situation, the change to come from inside, from the Cubans, as opposed to being imposed by us on the outside. I think a military intervention is going to be a lot more difficult and violent than it was in Venezuela, and I don't think it's going to be as successful. I think you have to harness the power of the Cuban people and the Cuban military, for example, to make that change.
That's quite a task.
It is indeed.
Is it doable?
But as you know, we used to tell people in the CIA, if it was easy, they'd give it to the Boy Scouts, not us.
I'm not sure that there's any. I mean, obviously, the military and the CIA have contingencies and war games on everything. But I don't think that there is any next day planning on and you know, what is it called end state concept after the decision to pull out. Maduro and wife, and I do think that it was very much in the interest of Rubio to let this happen, to put the screws on Cuba. Cuba has 60 years of getting by with near starvation. I've been there watching people go through the the extreme lack of calories for themselves and feeding their kids with the paltry amount of food they have as they shrink and get hungrier and hungrier. This would take anything either in Venezuela and Cuba to really put through a fast change, or anything that involves regime change or democracy building would not take place without American presence, which I don't think the United States, I don't think Republicans have a stomach for it. That's it. They're already showing that they're blocking, trying to block Trump. There's going to be tens of thousands of troops would be involved. Either way, you would have chaos in both places, and it's going to go back down to the Colin Powell dictum: you break it, you got to fix it. It's just not going to work. We're in trouble here, and it's moving toward chaos in Venezuela first, and possibly with the screws enough on Cuba.
Yeah. I was just going to say, Peter, yes, the Cubans have been incredibly resilient over the decades in surviving the U.S. blockade and all the other sanctions we put on it.
And defeating many CIA schemes.
And many CIA schemes. But I do think Luis is right that things really have gone downhill dramatically in the last few years. I mean, I was there a few years ago and was struck just how much worse the life in Havana had become since I had been there like 10 years earlier. I mean, it was markedly different, and that was and that was before, obviously, the pressure that this administration is putting on it. So, whether that leads to regime change or a toppling, I have no idea. But
both regimes are knocking off any power of opposition to this day, to this hour, apparently, from the New York Times. The Venezuelans are out being pretty heavy handed and going after any sign of opposition. Doesn't look easy to me.
I want to switch gears a little bit, Peter, because you did a good piece in Spy Talk the other day about the parallels between the seizure of Maduro and to put him on trial for drug trafficking and the U.S. invasion of Panama to seize Noriega and put him on trial for drug trafficking. And there were some striking parallels. I, too, covered the Noriega trial in Miami many years ago and got a real inside look at how these big drug trafficking cases are put together. And it's often not very pretty.
Yeah, that's when you and I first met, Mike, as a matter of fact.
You guys are old.
Yeah.
We feel it.
We don't have to remind everybody that.
I do think there are a tremendous number of parallels in the way George H.W. Bush decided to go in and grab Noriega, and the way Trump went in and took Maduro. I would have to say that, yes, these were both thugs, no question about it. I would say that Maduro was a more major league thug because he had a bigger playing field. But in both cases, I walk away from saying that there was a level of ego and domestic interest that kind of overwhelms. That overwhelms any desire to be capturing a heinous drug trafficker. In the case of Noriega, and it's not my thing, it's even not me saying this, even I recall very well General Werner, the head of the Southern Command, who was deposed because he objected to the invasion, said, this is the wimp factor. George Bush is going to invade Panama to prove that he can. And I came away saying that despite everything, that made a lot of sense. And I think here, Trump is, in many ways, this is a bully boy action to do something that, yeah, this no love lost for Maduro either. But what's really going on here?
Yeah, he said in a New York Times interview, apparently the Times got a couple of hours with Trump in the Oval Office, which they're heralding today. He went on about how, you know, Jimmy Carter failed with the desert, that operation to free U.S. hostages in Iran. And he went on about how, you know, Biden's screw up of the Kabul withdrawal. And he's always comparing himself. He's always leading with his ego. And that seems to be the case here with Venezuela. I've done something that no other president could do.
Can I just go back to Noriega for a moment? Because my takeaway from covering that trial many years ago is it really shows the sort of vagaries of drug trafficking prosecutions. Because at the time, there were two major Colombian cartels, the Medellin cartel and the Cali cartel. And they were rivals, right? And Noriega had been dealing with the Medellin cartel, and many of the witnesses were convicted Medellin traffickers like Carlos Leiter, who got all sorts of benefits, reduced sentences. I was astonished to read the other day that Leiter, who was like one of the biggest drug traffickers of his era, controlled an island in the Bahamas, is actually a free man to this day, thanks in part to his testimony against Manuel Noriega. But one of the crucial witnesses against him was a guy named Ricardo Bolotnick, who was actually an accountant for the rival Cali cartel. And before turning himself in to testify against Noriega in the interests of the Cali cartel, he got a $1.25 million bribe from the Cali cartel traffickers. So basically, we were using witnesses, or a key witness produced by the rival drug cartel, to get the Medellin cartel that Noriega was dealing with. And you know, like I say, you can call that justice, or you could call it something else, I suppose.
What do you call it, Luis?
I call it standard U.S. policy. Having worked in Latin America and doing counter-narcotics, it is extremely common to use, as one DEA guy put it, half a loaf is better than none. And you'll use one trafficking organization's support to get rid of another, and then you hope that you can then turn on the other one.
This is the definition of the self-licking ice cream cone.
It is. I was in Mexico, and I would watch the U.S. government work with Mexican elements of Mexican law enforcement to get rid of cartels. And all we were doing was eliminating the competition for the Mexican law enforcement to take over the drug trafficking. You know, look, we got a president pardoning the Honduran president for drug trafficking as we grabbed the Venezuelan president for drug trafficking. Yeah, it's going to have absolutely no impact on drug trafficking. It'll help make their case. And that's about all that they really care about.
Did you have dealings with Noriega when he was a CIA asset?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, no, it's a straightforward. I mean, I knew people who dealt with him, and Noriega provided for the agency a lot of services, including during the Contra period, the Central American Wars. Stuff moved through Panama and provided support to the Contras and other groups. Noriega provided a good offshore platform to look into Cuba to see what was going on. At the same time, he was cooperating with the Cubans. You know, you deal with what you get in the world of intelligence. And the U.S. government is fine with it as long as they get what they want and it's in their interest. And when it ceases to be in their interest, they'll turn on it. So the situation with Noriega is not uncommon.
So it was with Noriega.
Mm-hmm. My friend Don Winters was the CIA station chief in Panama. Don passed away quite a long time ago. And he appeared at the sentence reduction hearing for Noriega after he was convicted on 8 of 10 counts for 40 years. And Don said to the judge in open court, "Your Honor, General Noriega should be released forthwith because of the services he paid the United States." Hmm. Didn't work, but that's what he said.
And as you wrote yesterday for Spy Talk, Peter, we're likely to see a similar pattern with the prosecution of Maduro, with the U.S. Shortening the sentences of imprisoned Venezuelan drug dealers, et cetera, to induce them to testify against Maduro.
Yeah, the United States to successfully prosecute Maduro is going to have to put more people on the stand than just DEA agents and FBI agents. They're going to have to put warm, convicted, and acknowledged drug dealers to say what they know about this heinous drug dealer Maduro, even if it's hearsay and they've never met him, which is another thing that I pointed out in the story. According to federal guidelines, prosecution can put hearsay witnesses up, but the defense can't. I heard them say that this happened. Maybe it did, maybe it didn't. But defense can't do that. So it's kind of a tilted playing field, and Maduro is not going to see the light of day anytime soon.
Well, this is a fast-moving story, to say the least, and I'd say the outlook is decidedly cloudy. We don't know what's going to happen. These guys in the White House, et cetera, they seem to be flying by the seat of their pants, making it up as they go along. I can't see any strategic plan here. I mean, they'll talk about overthrowing Greenland and, you know, and hitting Iran and striking Nigeria. And I mean, gotta wonder if there's any adults in charge at this point. But you have to give credit to the U.S. military and special forces and CIA for a swift and hygienic removal of Maduro. Hell of an operation.
Not quite hygienic. Now the estimates are, 75 to 80 people may have been killed in that operation.
Well, it's not a lot better than Iraq. So, anyway.
Low bar there.
And that's the way it is this week in January 2026. Luis, thank you so much for coming on again. You're a great friend of Spy Talk, and we appreciate it. And Peter, we look forward to continuing great reporting and work from you on this issue. So thanks so much for everything.
Pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
Hey, it's Jody Hamilton.
And Sean Smith-Pierce.
Here's a taste of what you might have missed from the Politics Bar.
Jody, I was listening to you this morning, filling in for Steph. You and Chris were debating, and just for the record, Jody is right. Chris's argument is that there is some truth to what's being said about the left being in their own information silo. Right.
Basically, we started talking about how Gavin Newsom has invited people on his podcast, high up MAGA guys.
Yeah. Well-known right-wing propagandists. That's what they are. Yeah.
And my argument is he shouldn't be inviting them because nobody on that side is listening to Gavin Newsom.
Right. It doesn't help to bring propagandists into a sphere where truth matters because they're just going to lie their asses off anyway.
Right.
So here is a public service message for Chris Lavoie. Jody Hamilton is right. Catch all that and more weeknights at the Politics Bar. Available through your favorite progressive radio station, your favorite podcast player, or online anytime at thepoliticsbar.com.